Will the Duval County School Board sue the city? Good morning and live from Studio 5. This is First Coast Connect, and I'm Melissa Ross. Thanks for listening. Just ahead this morning, a conversation with School Board Chair Lori Hershey as educators fight for more money for local schools. Join us. You can dial us up right now. It's 549-2937. Then later, a new report on climate change and human rights should have a Florida feel. Plus, what you need to know for Florida's back-to-school sales tax holiday. It's coming up this weekend. All of that and more just ahead. But first this morning, the Duval County School Board held an emergency meeting last night. They've decided to move ahead with hiring a private attorney in their fight with the city over a sales tax referendum for school repair and construction. Meanwhile, new reports this week say the board is allegedly being pressured to give local charter schools an upfront $150 million payment as part of any deal. Lori Hershey is chair of the Duval County School Board and joins us now in studio. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Thanks for being with us. We'll go to your calls in a moment on this issue. It is a hot one. 549-2937 to call us. Emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. Tweets to @MelissaNJax. So what happened at last night's meeting?
So actually, it was a meeting last week when we voted to approve outside counsel.
Stand corrected.
And that was based upon the fact that the following day I was having a meeting with Jason Gabriel where I did ask him for outside counsel and his response was no. However, during that meeting, he shifted to want to seek an avenue more of a mediation and called in City Council President Scott Wilson where we outlined some next steps. So at this particular point, we are giving it a few days to a week or so to work out and see what those next steps look like.
So, in other words, you may or may not take legal action against the city over this whole matter?
Well, at this particular point, we thought that it was best to give the avenue of mediation a chance. At that particular time, we had not received the 100 questions that we got from the city council. Actually, our superintendent and her staff have responded to that. I believe they will be getting those answers today. It was interesting that the questions that were asked by the city council ranged from what is our marketing plan to get this passed by the voters to questions from the 1960s about schools. So there weren't a whole lot of questions about the referendum, a lot of questions about detail and use of dollars for charter schools.
And let's talk about that. You are seeking a referendum on the ballot this year to ask voters to approve a half-cent sales tax to create a pot of money to repair and shore up some of the oldest school buildings in this state. These are school buildings where air conditioning frequently doesn't work. There's mold, crumbling infrastructure, lack of Wi-Fi, inadequate plumbing, I mean, you name it. These are old and sometimes crumbling schools. Let me ask you as a follow-up, as the Florida Times Union is reporting this week that the mayor's political advisor, Tim Baker, and the mayor's recently retired chief administrative officer, Sam Musa, have reached out to the school board and offered their services as consultants to you, the board, to the tune of $12,500 a month for up to 3 years to help you get this referendum through the committee process on the city council and get it passed. What about this report?
Well, that is true. As a matter of fact, after I had that conversation with Mr. Baker and with Mr. Musa, I called the Florida School Board Association President, Andrea Messina, to ask her some questions about that conversation and to get some guidance on next steps. I did, during my conversation with Mr. Musa and Mr. Baker, ask for a written proposal because some of the services that were suggested, I wasn't really sure if that was something even that the school board was able to do or if it had to be done by a PAC, and it was beginning to get blurry. So that is why I did ask for a written proposal.
There are several dozen charter schools in this school district. It's being reported that Musa and Baker are advising you that if you allot $150 million to charter schools out of this pot of money, that the referendum will pass. What about that?
Well, that number has gone up higher. I recently heard yesterday it was $250 million. So I think that there's been some slide in that number. I know that, the paper reported $150 million. Vice Chair Jones has referred to it as being held hostage. At this point,
do you
agree
with that?
Well, it does.
Do you feel that they're holding you hostage?
Well, I would say it feels more like extortion than it does, as well as being held hostage. The answer, the question that needs to be answered is, will the voters be able to decide, and if so, when? And this is taking, it's become a beast of its own.
You feel that City Hall is extorting the Duval County School Board over this issue?
Well, I believe that when things are not moving forward and there continues to be a demand for X amount of money to be set aside for charter schools, that it does begin to feel like a pay-to-play sort of situation, which is very concerning. I would also argue that we have about 32 schools. We approved about 7 or 8 charter schools last year. So in the fall, we will have approximately 40 charter schools in the city. I do not feel like this request for money is from the charter schools that are here. I believe it's for charter schools that will be coming to our city.
In particular, in the pipeline for Jacksonville are the IDEA charter schools. They plan to have a presence in this community. Is that what you're referring to?
I believe that those larger schools that are coming in, yes, that and in fact, in a recent meeting with someone from the Civic Council, I did ask the question, are you representing all charter schools in the city or charter schools that are not here yet? And IDA is the School of Hope operator that has been approved. And I have received a letter from Dan, who is the head of IDEA, and he has indicated 5 schools. So the way they do their math, it's very interesting. You might hear some people say 5 or 10. They have 1 campus, and on that campus they have a K-8 and then a high school. So you can count that as 1 location, or you can count it as 2 schools. It depends upon.
From the perspective of charter school supporters, including those on the city council who now hold the fate of this in their hands, this is simply an issue of fairness for charters. Your thoughts?
Well, we want to recognize, we recognize that charter schools are public schools, and that is why Dr. Diana Green has said that off the top, every school will receive X amount of dollars based upon square footage, whether it's a charter school or public school, to address school safety and security needs. So we do want to take care of our charter school partners, but we also keep in mind we did an extensive facilities report, and we would be asking that charter schools seeking dollars would do a similar report to identify their facility needs just as we did, versus setting aside money without giving it direction on how it's spent.
It looks as though any hope that you had to put this before the voters in 2019 is fading. Duval Supervisor of Elections Mike Hogan says the time frame is closed to hold a referendum this year. So what's your next move?
So I believe it has closed for November. There is still an opportunity for it to be in December. And at this particular point, we're waiting to see on what actions the city council takes in their upcoming. They've got finance and rules committee meetings, I believe it's next week, with a next city council meeting on August 13th.
One more question before we go to callers. Your colleagues in Clay County on the school board there have announced that they will directly take on their county commission over a similar fight, a push for a sales tax referendum for public schools. Will you follow in the lead of Clay County and go to the mattresses, as they say, on this issue?
Well, I believe the fact that the board has voted to seek outside counsel, it does mean that depending what turns out over the next couple of weeks, will dictate our next steps, but we are in a position to take legal action if needed.
Let's go to your calls now for Duval County School Board Chair Lori Hershey, who says the school board may take legal action against City Hall in their push to get a sales tax referendum on the ballot so that they can repair and shore up and in some cases build new schools in the city. What are your thoughts about all this? It's 549-2937. Susan is in Mandarin. Hi, Susan. Good morning.
I have three questions. One, Scott Wilson wrote a guest column in the Times Union, and I started looking up the answers to his questions on the website rduvalschools.com, and I believe I had found all the answers to his questions, and I was wondering if Lori Hershey thinks his questions have also already been answered. I also am wondering how much money Chartrand is making off the Kipp School that I know he loaned $11 million to help get the school built and is paying 3% interest, but I was also wondering how much he's involved in any profits. And also the third question is, if a charter school closes, does the building go to the taxpayer or does it go back to private investors? And if I might also add, if it's all right, I was posting answers. Scott Wilson has a Facebook page, and he posted his guest column piece on that. And so I was going through his Times Union guest column, and I was answering the questions for him because I was looking it up on rduvalschools.com, and I felt like I was finding the answers. So he had posted it on Facebook to his constituents or anybody that was reading these questions, and I mean, maybe you think I'm being disingenuous, but I really thought I was being helpful. No, the answers are here. People should know these answers are here. And he blocked me from his Facebook account.
Let me ask you, Susan, was it his personal account or his public account?
He describes himself as a city council member, and he posts public policy. So I think it's similar to the lawsuit that Trump just lost for blocking people on his Twitter account. He's discussing public policy, which is public education is something really important to me, and he's posting about that. So I don't know about the term official.
And a lot of points coming from you, Susan, down in Mandarin, and I thank you for calling. And let me just let everyone know that City Council President Scott Wilson has agreed to appear on this program. He will be here on August 15th, so I hope everyone listens on that morning. Let's get to her points. Beginning with, she pointed out that all of the members of the City Council had detailed questions for all of you on the school board about this proposed referendum. What about that part of her question?
Well, I would say that I did follow up with Board Member Smith Juarez, who is the school board representative for his district, and she had met with him in June, and then it's my understanding they had a phone conversation recently this week as well. So I think that some of the questions that he has asked, I heard asked at the meeting with the superintendent and I in the mayor's office. So I think to her point, some of those questions had been addressed before. I would like to address the question about charter schools and if they close. No, the school district does not recoup that and any dollars from that, nor take over the building.
Okay, hope that answers that question. And lots of calls, 549-2937. Whoever knew that a sales tax referendum for something as boring as patching up walls and things could be so riveting for so many people. All right, Tim is on the south side. Hi, Tim. Good morning.
Good morning. And I'd like to say I'm very supportive of you guys, and I hope this gets passed. Real quick, before I get to my question, when I moved here in 2006, I was coming from Virginia. I was in the military, and I had to put my kids in Duval County schools. And my daughter came home one day, and I said, "So how'd you like the school?" They said, "Dad, the work is easy, but the schools are crappy." So we actually had to move out of this Duval County to another county. And it was one of those things where I had to ride around and see these schools. And I'm like, wow, some of these schools, like, they were built in the 70s. So I'm not sure why there's a lot of pushback on getting this done if my daughters and my kids can see this in 06. My question is, for some of us old people, where are these charter schools at? What's the most famous charter school name in this area? Do they have football teams? Do they have athletics? Are there high schools? I mean, I'm just having a hard time wrapping my head around a charter school, and what does that have to do with public schools? Thank you.
So,
thank you, Tim.
If I could go ahead and answer some of those questions, yes, to your point, what has happened is we have had We have a laundry list of repairs that need to be done and a backlog of over $100 million of repairs that need to be addressed. And that does impact learning, and your child is very smart for recognizing that early on. Regarding charter schools, many of the charter schools in our city are K-8. There are only a couple that are a high school, one being Duval Charter at Bay Meadows and the other being River City Science Academy, which is located at the beach.
It's located at River City Science Academy
Beach Boulevard, I
believe. On Beach Boulevard, yeah, right as you come off the Hart Bridge, and has been a highly rated mm-hmm. school. Okay, and so, the whole point of this, we need to talk about is that we have the oldest school buildings in Florida. Some are close to 100 years old. And this deferred maintenance has been put off again and again and again. Now the bill has come due. And the politics of this have become much more thorny and difficult, I think it's fair to say, than maybe was anticipated.
Well, absolutely. I thought that this would be the easy part of the process to get. We're asking for a date on the ballot. And we recognize the fact that the city council holds those cards. I thought the hard part would be selling it to the public. And we haven't really even begun that campaign yet. It is difficult. And I think at the end of the day, if you talk to people who had served on the board previously and you had a candid conversation, they would tell you that this needed to be done, but few people wanted to touch it. And we have gotten to a point that we have got to take the bull by the horns and address these issues in order to ensure that public education continues to rise in Jacksonville.
Do you think you need the services of connected consultants like Tim Baker and Sam Musa to get this through the process, not just with City Hall and officials there, but with the public?
Well, certainly we do need some sort of organized campaign in order to sell it to the public. I think a lot of people, a lot of organizations do that when they are pushing a referendum. But I would think to get it on the ballot, it's a little concerning that we would need a lobbying and to hire someone to get a date on a ballot for the voters to decide.
Lots of calls for School Board Chair Lori Hershey. It's 549-2937 to join us. Anne is in Mandarin. Hi, Anne. Good morning.
Hello.
Hey, you're on the air.
Hello. I'll turn my radio down. I heard Matt Carlucci's interview last week, and he said when he knew he was running, and I probably even before his primary, if he had one, he started studying this issue so he could be up to speed when he was sworn in July 1st. And I don't understand how all the rest of these people who were newly elected managed to not know that this was coming up if they were representing their districts. And in my opinion, as far as the charter schools, no school is getting any number of millions of dollars up front. And if they are regular public schools, just like everybody else, they should be folded into the facilities condition index, evaluated by engineers. And if the school board intends to only pay for their safety and security measures, I'm okay with that. They are our public school kids, but they do not get anything else after that. They have gotten all the capital dollars from the state for the past 12 years. That's why we're in this situation. And that's what I have to say.
Okay, Anne, let's talk about that last part of her comment there. The capital dollars from the state and where they have been apportioned.
Right. So that's part of why we are where we are today, is that we've had sharing of dollars that have traditionally gone to traditional public schools shared with charter schools. And they are public schools. And I hate for this conversation to be a fight of charter schools versus traditional schools, because there are a lot of students, even in my district. As a matter of fact, I have 10 traditional schools and 9 charter schools in my district. So out of the 19 public schools in my district, I have almost an even split. So I hate to see this conversation pit charter schools against traditional schools, and that's part of my concern. I am not convinced that this fight for a specific amount of money to be set aside for charter schools is really a grassroots effort from the charter schools that exist here now.
You are, say that again, that last part.
I'm not convinced that this request for a specific pot of money to be set aside for charter schools is a grassroots effort from the charter schools that currently exist in Duval County.
Then how do you see it?
Well, I think that from conversations that I have had, I'm beginning to wonder if it's for charter schools that will be coming in the future. Again, these dollars are to address facility needs that we have been unable to address for decades. And charter schools, when they come, they're going to be new. And so I think part of this is a grab for dollars for charter schools. And there was a recent article in Redefine Ed in 2018 that identified the fact that currently for Schools of Hope, so a school like IDA could benefit from, there's over $240 million set aside in a state account that can only be used by them.
Lots of tweets, meanwhile, for School Board Chair Lori Hershey. Here's one from John. As soon as air conditioning malfunctions, bandwidth fails, or mold appears in our aging public schools this year, all stakeholders should let their elected officials know this is unacceptable. We can be our own best advocates if we speak up. Steven tweets the show, so glad Ms. Hershey is taking on City Hall. This extortion needs to be exposed, not just towards schools and the school board, but the entire city. Warren tweets the show, IDA, that's the charter operator you just mentioned, is in for a rude awakening trying to get their schools staffed in Jacksonville. KIPP can't even get enough teachers to work in their program, so adding five similar schools is bound to fail without structural change that attracts teachers to Jacksonville. What about that?
I don't know anything about staffing for KIPP, I don't really know how to answer that question because it seemed to be staffing for the KIPP and for the charter schools.
Yancey tweets the show, the rot is systemic from the Oval Office on down to local officials. We have to take back our government. My kids love the idea of democracy. We haven't gotten to see much of it in their lives. Is democracy being subverted in Jacksonville over this issue? You're an independently elected board who is unable to levy this referendum, which is guaranteed according to the strict letter of the language that puts you in power.
Well, that's correct. And that's part of the frustration with this debate and the fact that it's gone on for over 60 days. Since when is the right for voters to weigh in and make a decision about our schools, about their local government? Since when is that something that isn't allowed? I mean, and I've talked to a lot of city council people and they say, well, we recognize the need and we support it. And then my question is why can't you give me a date? And for the voters to weigh in. I think it's very important. I did some research recently reading about things that led to consolidation, and public education has always been at the center of the conversation for Duval County. But even going back to the 60s when we lost accreditation, it had to do with the fact that the city was not funding schools properly through tax dollars. And here we are in 2019 in a similar situation. We are one of the seven schools in the state of Florida, of the urban districts, that doesn't have an additional revenue stream.
Let me disclose to listeners that I do, my husband and I, we have two children in the Duval County Public Schools. That said, we are trying to do an even-handed look at this discussion. Okay, here's a tweet from Jim. Does Lori Hershey believe elected officials are seeking to create a market for privately run schools that would not exist if existing public schools were fully funded?
Well, you know, that is a question that I have struggled with. And I have often asked myself, is this fight to get a date on a ballot becoming bigger than just a date on a ballot and more of a push to privatize public education in Duval County? That's a question I often ask myself.
Here's another point of view from Brian. Some of these 100-year-old buildings sold to private investors could be transformed into clubs or event centers. Getting newer schools open could be a double benefit for the public. Are you missing what could be a benefit to the public?
Well, there are a lot of benefits. I had the opportunity last year to see firsthand how when a city went in and renovated aging infrastructure, rebuilt new schools, how it revitalized and brought economic revitalization to communities throughout the city. I know good things can come. Now, I will say that in the past, we have closed schools and sold those school buildings, and then they have sat and they have become areas of blight. So at this particular point, We are planning to close Ortega Elementary, but that is a school that will not be torn down. The other schools that will be closed are slated to be torn down in order to prevent blight in neighborhoods.
Here's an email from Sharla. I am sensitive to disrespect of women in power, especially Black women. I wonder if you share my concern that our new superintendent is not being respected as the leader we voted her to be. If you have noticed this, why do you think it is happening? This is directed to you, School Board Chair Hershey.
Well, I think that you make an interesting point. I am very thankful that Vice Chair Jones, there's an article in the paper today about a conversation similar to the one that I had. I, too, experienced that it seemed that when he spoke up, my story had a little bit more credence. So I believe that you could be onto something.
You think there is some gender bias towards you and your superintendent over this matter?
I will say that I was very concerned at a at a rules committee meeting earlier this year with some comments made to the superintendent, and I even questioned to Jason Gabriel if those comments would have been made if she had been a white male.
Okay, let's take one more call on this. It's Tom at the Beaches. Hi, Tom. Good morning.
Hey, I have two questions. Why don't you want the referendum on the 2020 ballot? And if you've already covered that, that's fine. And secondly, if you had a chance to look at the Times Union headline about Sam Moussa pitching, I'm not sure who on the school board, to get the referendum through.
Okay, yes. Let's take his first question first. Why not just do this next year?
You know, that's a really great question. And if June... it was changed by the Finance Committee to 2020, and it sailed out of there 7-0. It hit the Rules Committee and was deferred and then deferred again at the last City Council meeting in June. So to answer your question, that already had been amended, and that could have been resolved at the end of June, but it was not. So hence, it makes you wonder what the real issue is. That opportunity was there. It looked like it was going to pass. I don't know what happened between Finance and Rules that changed that. That puts us to square one. That's part of the frustration with being over 60 days out, not having any resolution.
And so with no resolution, as we go to break, the next steps for you and Superintendent Green?
Well, at this particular point, we want to be faithful to the mediation that we experienced on Wednesday with Jason Gabriel.
That's the city's lead attorney.
Right. And we would like to give the city council an opportunity to see the questions, the response to the questions that they asked. And hopefully that will be ample answers that will allow them to move forward.
Thank you so much for bringing us up to date. We appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Lori Hershey is chairwoman of the Duval County School Board. And up next, why a new UN report on climate change should have a Florida feel. We'll be right back.
Of space, hypnotic rhythms and quarter tone melodies of the Middle East, with music by Mirjan Dede, Dead Can Dance, Loga Ramin Torkian, Michelle Banabila, Masa Vadat, and more. I'm Stephen Hill, a program called Ecstatic Rhythms on the Next Hearts of Space.
Saturdays at midnight on 89.9 FM.
By the time today's babies are 80 years old, the sea is projected to have risen up to 6.6 feet. So what's being done to protect life on the first coast? On ADAPT from WJCT, you'll find stories about adaptation by everyone from the Navy to realtors and the city of Jacksonville. Join us now at adaptflorida.org.
Yeah. Take a drive with us into the Blues Horizon. The best in classic and modern blues. Every Monday and Wednesday night at 11. Right here on 89.9 WJCT.
This Going Green segment is made possible by A1A Solar.
Welcome back. A significant new report on climate change and human rights is expected to have somewhat of a Florida feel. Josh Gellers is Associate Professor of Political Science at UNF. He's here with more now in our Going Green. Hey, Josh.
Hi, good morning, Melissa.
So tell us about this report. Who's distributing it?
So this report is basically something that is going to be created by what's called the Special Rapporteur on Human Rights and the Environment. And it's part of the UN human rights system. So the UN Human Rights Council has a bunch of experts who work on different issues from the right to education to the right to food. And this one in particular works on environmental issues. And so his second major report that he's coming out with focuses on the relationship between human rights and climate change.
You're a member of the Global Network for the Study of Human Rights and the Environment. That's a pretty fancy title. So you contributed to this report. What was your contribution?
That's correct. So what we wanted to do was submit an input to the report that David Boyd, the special rapporteur, is going to submit to the Human Rights Council. And our submission focused on coastal communities and hydraulic fracking. And so I wrote the portion of our submission that focuses on how to protect coastal communities with a specific emphasis on Florida and Duval County.
And let's talk about the expected climate change impacts here on the First Coast and Florida. We're already seeing negative effects. What do you anticipate we are going to be looking at in the future?
So to get back to the human rights aspect of this, the ones that I highlighted in my submission were the right to adequate housing and the right to property. And we've already seen a report, for example, that says that by 2040, Jacksonville is going to have the most expensive effort to erect seawalls in order to avoid flooding from things like hurricanes and so forth. So that's our city government already allocated $4.5 million to move a bunch of houses or to have people leave those houses and relocate elsewhere. But the effort to create seawalls is going to cost $3.5 billion by 2040. And that's either going to come at the cost of budget or tax increases, kind of similar to what we were just talking about in the last segment.
And you referred to the buyout of some homeowners in the South Shores neighborhood, which is on the south bank of the St. Johns River, right across from downtown Jacksonville. Those homeowners are in a really low-lying area, and they've been repeatedly flooded. The city's going to buy them out. We can anticipate more of that as flooding becomes more frequent and water starts coming in more aggressively into populated areas. Now, Jacksonville, as you said, it was reported recently that Jacksonville would have the most cost to erect seawalls because we have so much coastline between the ocean and the river. But what if the city decided, well, we just simply can't afford to do that? What's the picture then?
I mean, that's when you're talking about massive human rights violations, because even if you wanted to talk about some of our national security issues. For example, when we think about Mayport being in an area that is also particularly vulnerable to sea level rise, we have a vested interest in seeing that that military facility continues to operate. But if it's not going to be feasible any longer, where do we relocate those people? Jacksonville stands to lose a lot, not only in terms of industry and housing, but in terms of our national security relations with the federal government.
That's something that I think we need to touch on, given that we're a military community. The impacts posed by climate change are a national security issue, and this is something that government agencies and the military have been dealing with and working on for years. Can you talk a little bit more about what that looks like and what the existential threat is to national security?
Sure. So a few years ago, the Pentagon came out with a report, and this was during a previous administration, that described climate change as what they called a threat multiplier. So the thing that makes this a little difficult to understand is that while our minds want to be able to go from A to B directly, climate change has this impact on all different aspects of our lives. And that includes things like housing, health, food, water, property. And so in terms of something like national security, you know, there's this huge debate right now in the popular discourse about immigration. Well, what we know about climate change is that it is at least in part responsible for some of the major immigration issues that we're seeing in parts of the world, like Europe, for example, and the Middle East. So if we want to avoid those kinds of issues increasing in the future and potentially putting a resource strain on our own government and our own land, then we have to be concentrated on addressing the problem head on.
And that means, number one, reducing emissions.
That's correct.
Weaning ourselves as a planet off fossil fuels. Number two, getting serious about adaptation and mitigation strategies. Let me make a personal plug for our new digital magazine here at WJCT that we recently launched. It's called Adapt. You can learn all about how the First Coast in Florida is grappling with adaptation to sea level rise and climate change. If you go to this website, it's adaptflorida.org. You can also check your flood risk at your house. You can enter your address right there on our website and see how vulnerable your property may be to flooding down the road. And as you write, Josh, the implications on the rights to housing and property above all else is what people here in Florida are really concerned about. Out of all of the stories that we have live now at adaptflorida.org, by far the most popular stories are the ones where people can learn about threats to their real estate. That is such a basic thing that Floridians need to know more about. Is my property safe? Is my property going to increase or decrease in value? What's my long-term plan for my property? These are the questions that Florida is increasingly going to have to address.
Yeah, our homes are incredibly personal to us, and I think we don't want to have to leave them. We don't want to see them subject to increasing hurricanes and things like that. So what happens with our homes, what happens with our land, are things that we are deeply connected to. And I think that that's the kind of human story that really resonates with us in terms of climate change in Florida.
Now, as you wrote in your contribution to this UN report, Jacksonville city government has started taking measures that look at the impacts of climate change and the associated flooding and storm surge due to sea level rise. They have started buying out homes in flood-prone areas. But what actions do you think Florida and Jacksonville should be taking to better prepare for climate change?
I think the number one thing that needs to be done is for the leadership at the state level to work on what's called the Climate Action Plan and then have that buy-in from local communities as to how they would contribute to the overarching state goal. Because that's one of the issues. If we aren't feeding into the larger objective by having each city explain how they're going to contribute to the overall state goals, then we're not going to, you know, be able to communicate and we're going to be operating at cross purposes. So I think that's the most important thing, is setting up a plan that addresses how the state as well as local communities intend to address climate change together.
Governor DeSantis, unlike his predecessor, Governor Scott, has appointed both a state science officer, and this week he announced the appointment of a climate officer. Although she doesn't have a background in climate change and environmental issues, he has appointed someone to take point on this issue for Florida. What's your reaction to that?
I mean, in terms of addressing the actual issues that Florida is encountering now and certainly will in the future, this can only be seen as a positive development. However, the real question is where the rubber meets the road, and is this going to result in more tangible policies? Are we going to talk about infrastructure hardening? Are we going to talk about moving people? Are we going to talk about planning and zoning kinds of restrictions that are going to be implemented, replenishing wetlands, things like that? It's going to have to be an all-hands-on-deck kind of approach. So while it's great that we have a couple of people who are going to be charged with addressing science issues and climate change issues, what's really going to matter at the end of the day is, do we see policies emerge from this administration?
Right. And as we follow that, I mentioned our website a moment ago. It's why we chose this topic for our digital magazine. And again, it's adaptflorida.org, because Florida is uniquely vulnerable among all 50 states. Florida has the most coastline. Second is Alaska, I believe. People mm-hmm. might not realize that. But we are in the Southeast, where we're in a real hot zone when it comes to increased sea level rise, according to projections, and we have the most coastline. So this is going to only become more and more important for Florida over the next 20 years. As you just said, there's about a 20-year window that officials are looking at and scientists are looking at when they try to plan for impacts, correct?
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of where we are now. And, you know, if you were looking at climate change issues a decade ago or two decades ago, it seemed like we had a much longer time span to be able to address these issues. But one of the sort of nasty consequences of climate modeling and trying to find out what kinds of impacts are likely to experience in the future is that there are unintended consequences and impacts that we couldn't count on, and the degree to which these things are happening at a faster pace than we anticipated. So these are the kinds of unknowns which are making it more difficult for us to figure out what to do, but that window is closing and we need to come up with some kind of comprehensive policy plan now, because we're already dealing with the impacts.
And going beyond the impacts to everyone in the state, in particular, you have written about this concept of climate justice.
Yes.
Can you explain that?
Right. Well, climate justice is a term that basically refers to the fact that there's a difference between what the developing countries have experienced or will experience in the future as a result of climate change, and then the actual climate stressors that are brought by the developed countries. So there's this kind of inequity between those who are responsible and those who are impacted. And so justice is basically fairness in this particular case. How can we make sure that the most vulnerable among us, whether it's within our own communities or other countries, are going to be protected because of the things that the developed world is largely responsible for?
Speaking of other countries, Paris, France just saw its highest temperature on record, 105 degrees. This is in a part of the world where people are by no means prepared to deal with that level of extreme heat. And so whether it's extreme heat, wildfires, hurricanes, sea level rise, any number of impacts, drought or heavy rains that ruin crops, there are so many tentacles to climate change and how it's going to impact everyone.
Right. And that's one of the important reasons why we call it climate change as opposed to simply something like global warming, because climate change involves different kinds of environmental impacts in different parts of the world. So it's not the case that we're only going to see warming or we're only going to see increased rains. Like you mentioned, there are parts of the world like the Sahel region, sub-Saharan Africa, that are going to see tremendous droughts. And so it's acknowledging all of these things are existing. All these things are increasingly likely under a world in which climate change is happening. And I was, unfortunately, or fortunately, depending on your position, I was in Paris during that day with our study abroad program, and they are admittedly not prepared for dealing with that kind of heat wave situation, especially not on a frequent basis. Most of the buildings there do not have air conditioning. I can tell you our students weren't particularly happy about that, but it's the new reality in which we find ourselves.
And we look forward to the report meanwhile, and we thank you for your contribution to it. He's Josh Gellers, Associate Professor of Political Science at UNF, also a member of the Global Network for the Study of Human Rights and the Environment. Thank you.
Thanks very much.
Well, up next, how you can save big this weekend for back to school and more. Florida's sales tax holiday is coming up. We'll be right back.
ServPro of Jacksonville South and Arlington remind you to act fast, whether it's water, mold, or fire damage. ServPro of Jacksonville South, 721-2230, like it never even happened.
Constanji, Brooks, Smith & Prophet, LLP, representing local and national employers in labor, employee relations, and workplace law matters since 1946, with offices in Jacksonville, Tampa, Miami, and Lakeland. More at Constanji.com.
Would it surprise you to know that while you're sleeping, your smartphone is sharing your personal data with companies you've never heard of? On the next Fresh Air, Jeffrey Fowler talks about some of the ways our phones, computers, and smart speakers harvest and use information about us. Fowler writes a consumer-oriented technology column for the Washington Post. Join us today at noon on 89.9 WJCT, your community, your world.
Linguist Gretchen McCulloch's new book breaks down the rules of internet language. Take LOL. McCulloch says now LOL doesn't always mean laughter.
If I say, I hate you, lol, now I'm joking, so it's fine. I'm not laughing out loud while I hate you. I'm undermining my message and saying, I hate you, but I'm not serious about it.
The book Because Internet and analysis of the second Democratic presidential debate this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Today at 4 on 89.9 WJCT, your community, your world.
State attorneys general have significant powers. Are they using the law to play politics? Together, they shape national policies on big issues like immigration and the opioid crisis. We'll debate the role of state AGs and concerns about political activism with the attorneys general of Oregon, Arizona, and Colorado next time on 1A.
Today at 10 on 89.9 WJCT.
Welcome back. Well, finally this hour, it is your time to save. Yeah, Florida's back-to-school sales tax holiday is coming up this weekend, but it actually runs for 5 days. Here's some more good news. This year, you can also get technology items tax-free, along with all those clothes and school supplies. James Miller with the Florida Retail Federation is on the line to tell us more. Hey, James, good morning.
Good morning. Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you. And let's explain, first off, what is Florida's back-to-school sales tax holiday?
Well, it's the opportunity for Floridians across the state to take advantage of not having to pay sales tax on thousands of different items, the biggest of which you mentioned is technology is included this year, which it wasn't last year. So any technology items up to $1,000 are tax-free. So you're looking at saving $60 or $70, which is a nice chunk of change to have back in your pocket. And any clothes, shoes, or bags, $60 or less, and any school supplies, $15 or less.
That's such a good deal for so many families. So if you want to pick up a new laptop, a phone, even if you don't have a student in school, this is the weekend to do it, right?
Exactly. And to your point, with more and more schools, especially K-12, going with a more technology-based curriculum, parents being able to go out and buy a tablet or buy a laptop or even just buy a desktop for the house is vital for students being able to keep up with the trend in more adaptation of technology by more and more schools each year.
Let's explain, too. Usually this has been held on a weekend, but this year it is taking place August 2nd through the 6th. So things kick off at midnight Friday night, and they run all the way through Tuesday. Is that right?
Yeah, I guess it kicks off midnight. Would it be Thursday night? Friday
midnight
morning?
Thursday night.
Yeah. So it goes Friday through Tuesday. So anytime, any stores you visit or any online stores you visit from Friday to Tuesday, you will not have to pay sales taxes. And yes, normally, or I should say traditionally, it's been 3 days. We've had the sales tax for 22 years. It's been in business for 22 years. 18 of those 22 years, we've actually had it. We actually didn't have it in 2008, 2009 during the recession. And so this year, it's back up to 5 days, which is great, which means that for two things. One, consumers aren't slammed into one weekend, Saturday and Sunday, trying to get everything else or everything they need along with everyone else, excuse me. And also for retailers, it allows them to space out not only their customers' service people and their workforce a little better, but it allows them to manage their inventory a little better without having this big rush of people come in on just 2 days. Instead, it's going to be spaced out, so it'll be a more pleasant shopping experience for the consumer and more easily managed by the retailers.
Sure. And in fact, it's Florida's second busiest shopping holiday behind Black Friday. No surprise there. Now, you mentioned online retailers, James. Are you referring only to local online retailers? Say I wanted to go to a mega site like Amazon or Best Buy to buy some items. Would the sales tax holiday apply there or not?
Yes, it would. If they have a presence in Florida, they would be required to exempt those items from having to pay sales tax. And so if you buy an item outside of the state of Florida, doesn't have a presence in the state of Florida, because we do not have e-fairness here in Florida, those companies, those third-party companies, maybe you buy through Amazon, don't make you pay sales tax anyways. Unfortunately, that gives them that competitive advantage the rest of the year against Florida retailers. But at least for these next 5 days, everyone's on the same playing field, which is great.
And how much do families save on average when they take advantage of the tax holiday in Florida?
Well, when you're looking at K through 12 parents spending upwards of almost $700, you know, figure that out, you know, around 6-7%, that's a lot of money. And then also when you're looking at parents buying for college students, it's almost $1,000 when you factor in dorm supplies and, you know, things that maybe a K through 12 student wouldn't necessarily need. But $1,000, you know, at 6-7%, once again, a lot of money that's adding up. One thing I want to remind your listeners is that this is for people of all ages. Even though it is called back to school sales tax holiday, it is the Floridians go out and shop sales tax holiday.
Exactly.
If you're a business person looking to get a new shirt or a pair of pants or shoes, or a senior citizen looking to get new clothes, this is the weekend to do it. It's not, you don't have to have a child under your arm, you know, to go in the store and appreciate it. There's not security guards kicking people out of the stores if you don't have a student or, you know, an eligible student under your arms. Anybody can go, anybody can enjoy this, and we encourage them to do so.
That's right. This is for everyone. The sales tax holiday kicks off Friday, runs through Tuesday, so you have 5 full days to buy items tax-free, and that includes online. We're talking clothing, school supplies, and technology items. That's new this year. So take advantage of it, and thank you so much. He's James Miller on the line for us from the Florida Retail Federation. Going to be a very busy weekend for retail in the state. Thanks, James.
My pleasure. Thank you again.
And that's our show today. Our producer is Heather Schatz. She'll be buying some back-to-school items this weekend. Michelle Corum is our director. She might, too. I know I will. How about you? Maybe I'll see you out there somewhere. Thanks so much for being here with us today, and send those emails with your feedback to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. Tomorrow, local activists join a National Day of Action for Refugees. We'll speak with them tomorrow. I'm Melissa Ross. This is First Coast Connect on 89.9. If you're listening to our rebroadcast tonight, keep listening for the Electro Lounge. We'll see you tomorrow.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.